Air Comfort Service Heating, Cooling, and Insulation. Weather.
The last weekend of March is here. A mix of clouds and sunshine on this Saturday, but we do expect scattered showers around and a windy 75. Tonight, clouds, some showers, some thunderstorms. Non-severe tonight. It's windy, though, 64. Sunday, an interesting day. Not raining all the time, but periods of rain and some thunderstorms. This is 97.1 FM Talk. Chief Meteorologist Dave Murray.
Experiencing history in real time every day.
Every day.
This is St. Louis's own 97.1 FM Talk.
The following is a paid program.
On the Money provides general information which may not apply to your personal investment situation. Investing is subject to risk, including the possible loss of principal. You should consult with your financial professional prior to making any investment decisions. Investment products and services are offered through Stifel Nicolaus & Company, Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE. Neither Stifel nor its financial professionals are legal or tax advisors. Bob Stockdale is Senior Vice President, Investments, and Eric Robert is Director, Investments with the ClearPath Wealth Management Group at Stifel. If you need assistance with your investments or have questions about the show, contact us at 636-695-2650 or go to clearpathinvesting.com.
Good morning. Welcome to On the Money. I'm Bob Stockdale, Senior Vice President Investments at Stifel, along with Eric Robert, Director of Investments at Stifel. And it's great to have you along today. We've got a great show lined up, lots to talk about. We go through times where the news is slow. We're not in one of those right now. Lots to talk about. Lots happening with the economy, with the markets. It's going to be a wild ride, I think.
It is, and so we're going to update you on the latest state of the ongoing market correction and some of the things you've been seeing in the news about trade and all these changes and how they could impact the broader economy. Of course, we'll cover the latest economic data as well. We're also going to jump into a number of different issues. We're going to talk about Roth IRAs and how their popularity has dramatically increased, particularly with younger investors.
I think it's about time.
Yeah, it's not new. Been around for a long time. We've been preaching that for a long time. But Roth IRAs, and especially Roth conversions, we hear a lot about Roth conversions. You might even hear people talking about them in advertisements and things like that. Roth conversions and Roth IRA contributions are not the same thing.
Yeah, they're not interchangeable.
And it doesn't always make sense depending on your circumstances. So we'll walk through some of that. We're going to talk about how you can get the most out of working with your financial planner. It's not a one-way relationship when you're working with an advisor, or at least it shouldn't be, in order for you to get the most value out of your situation. And we'll talk to you about how to do that. Have you heard about the situation with the genetic testing firm 23andMe, which filed for bankruptcy this last week?
Oh my gosh, yes, I heard about it.
We're going to talk a little bit about data security and what it means for you if you've used those services in the past. There are a number of government officials as well as information security experts out there giving some pretty strong guidance on how to handle managing your own personal data security if you have or someone you love has participated in those genetic testing. And it's this whole new world. Who would have thought that's something that we need to think about? But man, it's scary enough when you're talking about your financial information, people getting access to your email. What happens when they have access to your genetic code? I think more questions than answers,
scares
but we'll
me.
Dive into it.
Yeah.
So a lot to cover today, but let's jump into some of the latest economic data. Now, of course, last week, the Federal Reserve met and did not increase interest rates, but we did get some more commentary from the Fed on what they expect to have happen as this year goes on. Right now, they're still projecting two additional rate cuts between now and the end of the year. I suspect that answer is going to change over time.
I would guess so, too.
Yeah, the CME... Go ahead.
Did you get the feeling that was the shortest Fed meeting that we've ever, or at least when Chairman Powell came out,
yeah,
it was the shortest meeting he's ever given?
There wasn't a whole lot to say, right?
Really, basically, we just have to wait and see where things go.
Yeah. Yeah, and even the Fed is subject to the same uncertainty that all of us are.
That's right.
Right now, the next Fed meeting is coming up on May 7th, and there is about an 11.6% probability that the Fed will cut rates at the May meeting. By the time you get out to the June 18th meeting, the script flips. You've got a bit over a 65% probability as of the show that we'll have our first rate cut of the year in at the June meeting. Those probabilities continue to increase as the year goes on, but it's all going to be, as Chairman Powell said, dependent on what happens with the data in the coming months. Speaking of, we did get some new data on housing in particular. We had home builders saw a small increase in the pace of newly built homes in February. Sales of newly built homes in the U.S. rose, with the biggest jump happening right here in the Midwest. New home sales rose 1.8% to an annual rate of 676,000 from a revised 664,000 the prior month, according to the Commerce Department. Those new home sales figures were generally in line with expectations. The rate of new home sales pulled up by a 20.6% jump in February in the Midwest, as well as a 6.6% increase in the South. Now, the median sale price for a new home in February was $415,500. That was a bit below that median price in the prior year of $420,900.
So does that indicate that we're getting a reaction to lower interest rates?
It seems, well, you know, the interest rates weren't particularly low in February. They've come down a bit since then.
Yeah, quite a bit.
But I think people were generally impressed by seeing that, you know, month over month uptick despite the relatively higher rates. Speaking of mortgage rates, an average 30-year fixed rate mortgage is currently at 6.8%, according to MortgageNewsDaily.com. Now, the 15-year fixed is down at 6.22%. Neither of those are a bargain at this point.
It's hard to get 2.5% or 3% out of your head.
It really is. We're not here to tell you that those days are coming back anytime soon. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note is sitting at around 4.37% right now. It got a bit lower over the last couple of weeks, and it's come back up a bit. But, you know, the goal, I heard an interview with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent over this past week, and it was actually very good, by the way. All In podcast, so if that's something you look up.
Okay.
He spent about an hour with them. It was the first time I've heard Secretary Bessent have just a really free-form and long-form opportunity to explain the Trump administration's economic policy and how it all hangs together, what they're doing with the tariffs, what they're doing with the Department of Government Efficiency, what they expect to do with tax rates. So I encourage you to go listen to it. But in that, he did speak to their real, you know, one of the metrics that they're watching is that 10-year Treasury yield. And their goal here is to bring the deficit down from a little less than $2 trillion presently and essentially cut that in half. That would bring the debt or the deficit to GDP ratio back down to closer to 3%. And they believe if they can get the deficit closer to 3%, it's going to bring Treasury yields down, not back to pandemic levels. That's not the goal, but just back to more, you know, reasonable levels, at least in recent history, giving people hopefully lower mortgage rates, auto loans, things of that nature. So I thought it was an interesting interview. While we're still on housing here, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index rose 4.1%. for January.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a pretty big jump and a slight increase from the prior reading in December. This does cover the 9 census divisions, which reported that average 4.1% annual return. The 10-city composite saw an annual increase of 5.3%, while the 20-city composite posted a year-over-year increase of 4.7%. New York was at the top of the stack there, reporting the highest annual gain of 7.7%.
So what's up with that?
I guess it's back on in New York City. You also had a couple other larger cities.
It's election related, I think.
Yeah, Chicago and Boston showed annual increases of 7.5% and 6.6% respectively.
Wow, interesting.
Interestingly to me, Tampa showed the lowest return, falling 1.5% year over year.
You know, there's a tremendous amount of concern with some folks in Florida that the cost of insuring against everything that happens down there, or potential things that can happen, hurricanes and whatever, it's just getting out of control. And I've heard that that perhaps some people are considering, well, the prices are coming down because things are going for sale.
Yeah, just some anecdotal evidence, because we had spring break, got to spend some time down with all the kids at the Gulf of America.
Yeah.
And the house that we rented, so we've been there a couple times, and this house has been for sale now for, I'm thinking, close to 18 months at this point. They started off with a $7 million price tag. It's down just below $6 million now. Still for sale.
Still on the move.
Still, yeah still sitting there.
Interesting.
And you know, when you're talking about these vacation rental homes like that, I was running some math while I was down there, just go, well, what's it take if you're, you know, I kind of have an idea what the average rent is for a week based on when we've gone. What's it take to make that cash flow if you have to get a mortgage? I can't make it work. I think that's why it's on the market, why a lot of these houses are on the market. If you're not a cash buyer, it's hard to make anything cash flow with a 7% loan.
Well, Florida was booming so much for a long time that you knew things had to slow at some point. Maybe this is where we are.
Yeah. And you know, the other interesting thing to me is that we were, as I mentioned, at the Gulf. So this was on 30A. South Florida, I understand why that's probably always a hot market. I mean, they still have the insurance issues and all that, but it is 80 degrees in February.
They got the money. Yeah. That's right.
But you know, the all of the buildup along the Gulf in the more northern part of Florida, yeah, it's still nicer in the winter than it is up in St. Louis, for instance. But you're not swimming in the ocean, you know.
Right.
It's a different ball game. We also got some updates on consumer confidence. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index fell to a four-year low for March of 92.9. That's down from 100.1 in February. That's the fourth decline in a row and the lowest reading since January of 2021. Now, the reason why that consumer confidence number fell was not because of current conditions. Those were actually reasonably stable, but future economic conditions, according to the survey.
Political?
I definitely think there's a political element to that. I'm not saying that the survey respondents were thinking politically, but I think what's happening in the news and all of the things that have been leading to the correction that we're currently dealing with are weighing on consumers.
Makes sense.
Last but not least, durable goods orders. So this is a manufacturing indicator. Durable goods orders are manufactured goods that are intended to last 3 or more years. So everything from a toaster to an airplane rose almost 1% in February. That was more than expected. Interestingly, January's number was revised upward to 3.3%. Now, there's a story there. A lot of these durable goods orders were put in advance of what's going on with the tariffs. You know, people trying to get ahead of tariffs being applied to some of these goods. All right, one last thing for you. The Atlanta Fed's GDP Now estimate. So we are in the final week of the first quarter of the year, and we'll be entering the second quarter. We don't quite have all of the data yet for first quarter GDP. We've spoken about this a couple of times in the last few weeks, but the most recent update for the Atlanta Fed GDP Now tracker, Bob, do you have a guess at what they're suggesting first quarter GDP is going to be?
1.7.
If you add a negative sign in front of it,
whoa,
you're close. Negative 1.8. Now, don't freak out, okay?
Where are they getting that?
Here's where they're getting it. So this is just a calculator. All they do is, as the inputs to GDP come out, they add them to the calculation. The issue here is first quarter real gross domestic investment growth. So that's in internal domestic investment, business and private investment, did decrease from 9.1% to 8.8%. Those are great numbers for what it's worth. However, imports, that's the issue. When we import goods into the United States, it subtracts dollar for dollar and point for point from GDP. And you've had a lot of businesses, a lot of consumers pull in
scrambling
a whole bunch of imports to try and get ahead of tariffs, and that's going to subtract from first quarter GDP. Now, even the Atlanta Fed kind of has an asterisk by this number, saying don't assume that that's what the number is going to be. The consensus forecast still has first quarter GDP somewhere in the upper 1% range, you know, 1.5 to 1.9%.
Right, what I said.
Yeah, yeah. So you're not off from the consensus forecast, but the GDP now calculator is looking pretty tough right now. We'll see where it lands. We do have a lot more to cover here on the money. We're going to talk about housing prices as well as what you need to be being in a correction in the S&P 500 right now. Then NASDAQ remains in correction territories. Just a reminder, a correction is a 10% or more decline from the most recent all-time high. And it just has a lot of people asking, well, what do I do right now? What should I do? What can I do that might help this situation? You know, we spend quite a bit of time talking about what not to do. Don't overreact. Don't freak out. Don't sell everything. Those are generally not productive things to
keep a long-term perspective on everything.
But there are some helpful things that you can do in this sort of environment. I think it's a good reminder that while equities have pulled back a bit, you're not in the gutter right now. So if this kind of mini stress test in your portfolio has rattled you, because a lot of people for the last several years kind of forgot what it looks like when risk enters the equation. Last time we saw that was 2022. It's not too late to make changes that are productive and timely to de-risk your portfolio if you're already rattled, because we're not here to tell you that this is over or it couldn't get worse before it gets better. It's not necessarily my expectation, but we don't know.
We don't know.
Nor do you. Nor do any of the people on TV actually know what's going to happen.
The people on TV don't know?
No, they don't. Go figure.
I'm shocked.
There was, I thought, a good piece here from Safal Nivashak, 13 Thoughts to Survive and Grow Through a Market Fall. And I wanted to bounce a few of these concepts past you as listeners. So, Bob, you want to start us off here?
Well, sure. You know, the first one they've got, the first thought is that the market is a pendulum, not a straight line, like so many other things, right? Politics, things like that. It says the markets don't go up in a straight line. They swing back and forth between greed and fear. When prices are rising, it can feel like they'll never come down, kind of like the last 2 years. And when they crash, they feel like they're never going to recover. But history shows that just isn't true.
Yeah.
And I think that's what you have to understand and learn if you're going to be a long-term investor and be successful, is that you're going to come into times where things look bleak. Doesn't look like anything's going to change. You're in a bad position. You may feel like doing something that you shouldn't do at that time.
Yeah.
And that's what this is all about.
You know, that leads into a second point here, which is similar to what we talked about before. Investors chase certainty, but investing is an uncertain game. And every time the market drops, people are always looking for someone who can give them answers like, when's it going to recover? How bad is this actually going to get?
Isn't that it?
Yeah. The truth is, nobody knows.
And on TV, they'll march out 20 people a day giving their opinion. Who knows if anybody's even right?
The best thing, and some people are wired pretty well with this. Many of our clients are. You should expect this. This is a predictable pullback, and I'm not saying anybody knew exactly when it was going to happen, but on average, about every 12 to 14 months, you have a 10% correction in the market. It's just going to happen. Yep. You need to accept it in order to be a reasonable long-term investor.
It's very easy to recognize these things in retrospect. Mm-hmm. Just like with the election and all the changes that you knew were going to happen. You know, I think a lot of people should have been thinking, well, you know, this is going to be a lot of uncertainty, and that's what we've seen. Mm-hmm. But you really didn't hear a lot of it until, I guess, the end of January or so.
It's also a reminder that not every type of company or investment is created equal whenever you're in a drawdown. And all those kind of steady eddy, blue chip companies, there are some people who are, you know, retirement-oriented investors especially, that understand they don't do well in bear markets, that they're just, it makes them crazy, they can't deal with the stress. And it's possible to put together your portfolio where these sort of times don't have to stress you out that much, because those steady eddy blue chip companies, many of them are, some of them are up, and many of them are just not really down that much. But if you get to enjoy that in a bear market, don't expect to be up 26% when the S&P is up 26%.
That is the catch, isn't it?
You can get to a really strong average annual return sticking to more conservative equity investments, but you're unlikely to outperform the broad market, particularly in a bull market, but you're going to be able to sleep a bit better at night whenever you're in a bear market.
Isn't that why we design portfolios for our clients? Because everybody's different.
Yeah. And we're just going to try and shoot straight with you to tell you what to expect on both sides of the coin. On the other side, we have many clients who are true growth investors, and they really want to get outsized returns in the bull market. But then we spend a lot of time talking about when things are good. You know, this thing can go down, not just 10 or 20%. It can go down 30% or more in a really difficult market environment. That's not where we are today. But those markets do come around. 2022 was the most recent where you saw the S&P down more than 30% for a time. And you need to be prepared for that for whatever portion of your portfolio is invested in more growth-oriented assets.
Well put.
Yeah. What do you want to talk about next here, Bob?
Well, you know, falling markets don't just reveal or destroy wealth. They reveal who you are. And I like this one because it's true. It's easy to call yourself a long-term investor, but when your portfolio is, and that's when your portfolio is growing, but when it drops, say, like you mentioned, 30%, every headline screams of a further fall. Your real self shows up, mm-hmm. and you find out what you're made of.
And it's always interesting whenever you're dealing with a client for the first time in a bear market or a correction.
Yeah, and, you find out a lot.
I had one of these conversations recently where I, you know, based on the client's way that they presented themselves and what they said their goals were, mm-hmm. they were much more growth oriented. But when their portfolio was only down about 6%. At the time,
sure,
they were already scared to death, and I said, "Hey, it's okay, and I appreciate you calling me to tell me how you actually feel right now. I want you to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is going to inform future recommendations because, fortunately, they were already a bit more conservative than the broad market. But you know, I was learning, and I think they were as well, that you know maybe being this growth oriented isn't right for you because if you can't stick with it when times get tough, it's really not worth it to be there in the first place.
That's the problem.
One last point on this article. This is not the entirety of what he writes about, but the best investors are masters of their mind. So you think about a Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is perfectly content to have some cash sitting on the sidelines in a wild bull market, and he'll wait years before he deploys that only whenever it's at attractive prices. It's easy to say, it's a lot harder to do. And you don't need to be wired exactly like Warren Buffett to do well as an investor, but you do need to understand who you are. If you're someone who can kind of take everything in stride and you know you have a plan where your income or whatever you're relying on in your investments just simply isn't at risk in any market environment, that's what we help you do with a retirement plan and a financial plan. That all works as long as you still understand how it works when things are going poorly. But no matter how much planning you do, some people, when the markets are fluctuating like this, they just can't handle it. And that's okay. We can help you too, but you just need to understand that about yourself in this sort of a time.
That's right.
Coming up next on The Money, we're going to talk about what the potential future path could look like for housing prices. Roth IRAs is any annuities cap your growth at such low rates that you may have been better off sticking with a really conservative invested portfolio. Like I said, we're not against annuities. They can be a tool to help you distribute income at higher rates than would otherwise be advisable with a normal invested portfolio, but it's critical to understand what you're signing up for, how it actually works, and how it's going to serve your needs over the long term. We help people do that every day. And if you're considering an annuity or you think one might be something that you need to consider, give us a call. You can call us at 636-695-2650 or go to our website, clearpathinvesting.com. That's clearpathinvesting.com. And we'll be happy to help you take a look at your situation, run a financial plan, and really make sure if this makes sense at all, that you're getting the best deal and the best bang for your buck. You know, annuities are one category that often confuse people. There's strong opinions on both sides. Here's something that most people agree on. Roth IRAs can be a pretty good deal for a lot of investors, and it seems like particularly younger people are picking up on that. There was an article this last week in the Wall Street Journal. Roth IRAs are all the rage with the young crowd. The article suggests that young savers are now flocking to Roth IRAs. Of those who contribute to a Roth IRA, 41% were under the age of 40 for the most recent data that's available in 2022. That's up from 28% in 2016, according to data from the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. Now, let's just take a step back here. What is a Roth IRA? Well, an IRA is an individual retirement account, and prior to the availability of Roth IRAs, most contributions to IRAs were tax deductible. Now, there are some strings attached to that. You can make a contribution to a traditional IRA and not receive a tax deduction. I'll give you some more information on that in a moment. But if you're above those limits to get a deduction on your traditional IRA, or maybe even if you're below them, often if you're below them, that means you're in a relatively low tax bracket, it may behoove you to consider a Roth IRA. What's the difference? When you put money into a traditional IRA, assuming that it's a deductible contribution, which may not be a safe assumption for you, you get a tax break on the money. Essentially, you don't pay taxes on that contribution in the year that you make it. But then, from there on, however that is invested within your IRA, all of the balance, as well as the growth associated with those traditional IRA contributions, become taxable to you when you take the money out. So that's the difference when you go to a Roth IRA. A Roth IRA is not tax deductible. Doesn't matter when you put the money in. As long as you're eligible to contribute, your Roth IRA contributions don't save you any money on taxes, at least today. But when the money goes into the account, 100% of the value of that investment is now tax-free for you, not just based on the original contribution, but importantly, all of the future growth is also tax-free. So when you take the money out of your Roth IRA, you know, maybe you've had it in there for 10, 20, 30 or more years, all of the growth associated with that investment is tax-free for you. Well, there are a few strings attached. This is often the case with retirement accounts. There's rules around how much you can contribute and whether you can contribute and whether you can receive a tax deduction. So for 2024, we do still have a little bit of time left. If you haven't yet filed your 2024 tax return, you can still make either a traditional or Roth IRA contribution, assuming that you're eligible. If you're under the age of 50, the maximum contribution for 2024 is $7,000. If you're over age 50, there is another $1,000 catch-up available, so you can contribute up to $8,000, assuming that you have the earned income. Note that if your spouse doesn't work and doesn't have any income, they can also make a contribution if you're married filing jointly. So you may be able to contribute twice those amounts, even if only one spouse works. And by the way, those contribution limits of $7,000 and $8,000 respectively are also true for 2025. You have up until April 15th or whenever you file your taxes to get in your contributions for 2024 if you haven't done so already. I mentioned earlier that there's income limits for whether or not you can make a deductible contribution to a traditional IRA. If you're a single individual filer on your tax return and you make less than $77,000 for your modified adjusted gross income, then you can make a full deduction of your $7,000 or $8,000 traditional IRA contribution. It means it comes straight off of your taxable income. You won't owe any taxes on that amount of money. But again, whenever you take the money out, it's going to be tax deferred. You will pay taxes when you take the money out. Now, once you make over $87,000 in modified adjusted gross income, you're no longer eligible to take a deduction for your traditional IRA contributions. I just do want to note, you can still make the contribution. You're just not going to get a tax benefit for it. That's why for most people, once you're over those amounts, by the way, if you're married filing jointly, I mentioned $77,000 is where it starts for single filers. For married filing jointly, you can make less than $123,000 in modified adjusted gross income and still make deductible traditional IRA contributions. Once you start getting over those amounts, you may want to consider, if you hadn't already, making a Roth IRA contribution. That Roth IRA contribution limit is not going to save you any taxes today, but you can make all the way up to $230,000, married filing jointly, without while still being able to contribute directly to that Roth IRA. That starts to phase out between $230,000 and $240,000. Now, there's some other tricks there. We've talked on the show before about backdoor Roth IRAs. That's where you make a non-deductible contribution to your traditional IRA because you're over the limit to contribute directly to a Roth. And then you convert that non-deductible amount over to a Roth IRA. There's some strings attached to that, as there always are with retirement accounts. So I'm just going to encourage you want to consult with your tax advisor and your financial advisor before you try doing a backdoor Roth IRA, if that's applicable to you. So on these Roth IRAs, that's a great deal, especially if you're younger. That's what these younger folks, as mentioned in the Wall Street Journal article, are picking up on. When you are in a relatively low tax bracket and you can put the money into a Roth IRA and let that grow for 10, 15, 25, 35 years, that number may multiply multiple times. And that's all tax-free growth for you. Really encouraged to see that young people are taking these Roth IRAs more seriously. By the way, I mentioned the maximums that you can contribute, the $7,000 and $8,000 respectively.
$1,000. That's the average amount of money people in the U.S. are now spending on gas in a year. $5,000. That's crazy. If you drive, you have to download Upside, the free app that gives you cash back every time you get gas. That's right. You can earn real cash back with Upside just by buying the gas you're already buying. You can literally start earning cash back today.
I use Upside every time I fill up, and I've already made around $200-$300.
You're putting gas in your car anyway. Why not get real cash back? If you like free money, download Upside.
I'm saving the cash I earn from using Upside to help pay for a vacation later this year.
Download the free Upside app now to earn cash back every time you buy gas. Use promo code QUOTE to get an extra 25 cents per gallon on your first tank. You can cash out anytime right to your bank, PayPal, or a gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Upside app and use promo code QUOTE for a 25 cents per gallon bonus on your first tank. That's code QUOTE for a 25 cents per gallon bonus.
This is On the Money. I'm Eric Robert, Director of Investments with the ClearPath Wealth Management Group at Stifel. If you are 5-10 years out from retirement, or maybe it's coming up even sooner than that, your situation's changed and you've got to figure out whether and how you can retire and what that income is going to look like over time. That's exactly what we're here to help you with. Go to clearpathinvesting.com, clearpathinvesting.com, and we will offer a free financial plan consultation. We'll help you gather your data, understand your situation, put together a really thorough financial plan for you, not just looking at your investments, looking at the risks that are associated with your retirement income, whether you have pension income, Social Security, what happens if one spouse passes away sooner than expected, and how does that impact the other spouse's ability to continue income? How are you going to handle things like long-term care? Those are all parts of just understanding your overall financial plan and making sure that we've got all of your bases covered for whatever the future holds. Go to clearpathinvesting.com. We'll be glad to help you do that. The White Coat Investor, one of our favorite blogs that we kind of follow and review periodically, has an article out this past week called Don't Be Car Poor. And this is an issue that's pretty near and dear to my heart. You know, a lot of people, it just boggles my mind how much people are willing to spend on vehicles. These days it's easy. It's ridiculously easy to spend not just over $50,000, but over $60,000, even $70,000. And we're not talking about buying the highest trim Cadillac or something like that. I mean, just getting a decent, you know, heavy-duty truck or something like that. Not looking at anybody in particular.
Oh,
in
yeah.
In the studio.
You're talking my
man, but
yeah.
The thing that boggles my mind with it, Bob, is we work with people and help them review their financial situations all the time. And if you have a couple million dollars in the bank, and let's say you're headed into retirement, and you've got your mortgage paid off, and lots of, you know, you've got plenty of resources, there's nothing wrong with buying a new car. We're not here to
buy whatever you want at that point.
Frankly, we want you to. We want you to get what you want.
But can I?
Yeah, please do.
But if you have a 7 year or 8 year loan on a truck or a car, you're probably buying something that you shouldn't, because it's going to cost you a bundle, not just the sticker price, but all the interest.
I mean, my general rule is I don't like auto loans at all if you can avoid it. But whenever we had really low rates over the last few years, you might have gotten a 2.5% or even a 0% rate. I can wrap my mind around it. Don't go more than 5 years on a car loan.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Even if you plan to own the car longer than that, don't go more than 5 years auto loan.
But you have to admit, cars are so much better now. I mean, there's so many features.
They're not as good as my 86 C10 pickup. But it's not just the cost of the vehicle. You've got, in the state of Missouri at least, personal property taxes. The newer and more expensive the vehicle that you drive, the higher your ongoing personal property taxes are going to be, not to mention insurance, which keeps on going up more and more.
You know, personal property drives me nuts. Do any other states do this?
There are some others that do it, but it's certainly not universal. And
I moved here in 86 from Ohio, and they told me about this property tax. And I was like, what?
What? And I have to pay?
You pay every year on the same thing?
That I already own?
Yeah.
What is this, real estate?
It's my only gripe about Missouri. I love Missouri. Mm-hmm. Love living here now. But boy, that personal property tax
drives you nuts.
It's an irritant.
And you got to understand the total cost of that vehicle. Even if I'm not a fan of leasing cars, but sometimes people have valid reasons to lease a mm-hmm. car, depending on how many miles you're going to drive, what sort of deal you can get. But you know, I'm thinking of some of the newer electric vehicles here. I've had a lot of clients bring up after the fact. They get into one, and they think it's a great deal. I'm going to save all this money on gas, and all of a sudden they have to replace all of their tires every 20,000 miles. Because they're very heavy and low to the ground.
Oh,
and
didn't think about
that. And they're
not
cheap tires.
Yeah, those batteries are really heavy. Yeah.
It all makes a difference, and it all adds up. You can still buy a great used car that's only, you know, 2, 3, maybe 5 years old. I don't want to like get too heavy handed here, but the cars that they made a few years ago were still pretty darn good, and you can buy them with relatively low miles and save a bundle of money relative to buying new. That is still true. It only briefly wasn't there for a minute in COVID, and I think it broke some people's brains and thought, okay, now I'm going to buy a new car forever and ever.
Yeah.
By the way, with this tariff situation, the math is changing in real time.
That's going to be very interesting. You bet.
It is. Okay. Well, that's a PSA. I do want to point you to that Don't Be Car Poor White Coat Investor article. I think it's worth reviewing. If you're considering a vehicle purchase, used cars are still an option. But if you got a whole bunch of money sitting in the bank and you want to buy a new car, by all means, go for it. We only have a little bit of time left here, Bob, but you know, 23andMe, we've mentioned it a couple times. So this is the genetic testing company where you would, you know, spit into a tube, they go pull out your DNA, and then it's really cool. They give you a full analysis.
I've seen it. I think my wife might have done it. I didn't.
Okay.
Really have any interest.
If that's the case, you need to hear this too.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
23andMe, the company, has come on some hard financial times, and they filed for bankruptcy this last week.
Right.
All of the data associated with the company is now up for sale. Now, hopefully, a reputable investor buys it and wants to continue the company, and they don't, you know, try and do anything with that data. But there's a risk here that if you have your genetic data in that database, it's for sale right now. There is a way to go delete it. NPR, of all places, had a pretty good write-up on how to delete your 23andMe data after the company's filed for bankruptcy. So I'd point you out, there's a couple other articles out there that'll do it, but you need to log into your account. You go into settings. You'll find a section called 23andMe data. You can download your data first. You did pay for it, by the way, so you may as well download it before you delete it. But then once you've downloaded it, you can go to the bottom and click the delete data button, and then it's going to prompt you to permanently delete your data. If you don't, click the permanent.
All right. We're back. Second hour of the Home Improvement Show. Rich Orr is here for you. And again, anything you need, feel free to give me a call right here today, live on the air, 314-436-7900. We can get to you. We can help you out. And maybe some good advice. Maybe we can help you with some work you're considering doing around the house, or maybe something that you've done or you're considering doing. I did want to touch a little bit back on a couple of the calls we've had so far, with Karen asking about the deck floor and the oil base stained and putting a product on that deck floor. And really, the theory comes in on a deck board like that to really keep everything out. If you could seal off 100% of all six sides of that board, that would be totally great. That would really make that board last well. But if you only seal the top and then you're getting moisture and stuff from the bottom and it starts rotting away, we see it sometimes with vinyl siding and metal wrapped over top of wood. And if water gets back there, the wood is rotting away. The metal wrap never goes away, but the wood completely goes away. And then the metal falls off because it's being held by the wood. So that's a big thing to consider is that moisture and what gets to it. And it's a big deal on wooden decks for sure. But hey, we've got Lee on the phone. Let's go to our friend Lee and see what's happening. Are you there? Can you hear me?
Hey, Rich, can you hear me?
I can. What's going on, sir?
I've got squeaky hardwood floors, and I'm wondering what's causing it. Basically, you know, we've had a rough winter, and my furnace is located in the basement utility room, and it's located beneath the kitchen, and that's where the squeaking is. Now, I've looked at the floor joist, and I've looked at the underlayment, and it doesn't look like it's separated at all. You know, to my understanding, that floor joist, the underlayment is glued down and then screwed down before you put your flooring in.
Sure, yeah.
And I'm wondering, I've got an Apple Air humidifier attached to my furnace to give a little bit of moisture, you know, so just yes. Not just getting all that dry air.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yes.
Yeah. But this year it's been, I haven't had it in the past. This year is just like, man, I walk in my kitchen because the furnace is located
right underneath it,
under the kitchen. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the kitchen area. How old is your house?
Oh, boy. I want to say close to 40 years old.
Oh, okay.
But it's been all updated, you know, the hardwood flooring and all that stuff. You know, everything is. But I don't understand why I get these squeaks in the floor this year.
Yeah, have you noticed any space between the actual hardwood floor boards, like kind of opening up where you can kind of see a little bit of a 16th or an 18th inch space between the boards themselves?
Not really, you know.
Okay.
Not really. And I'm thinking, I don't know, really.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it is hard to tell because circumstances change over time. It does sound like possibly if you've never had it before and you're starting to have it, that maybe it is from the floor kind of drying out and shrinking a little bit. So then as it moves and it rubs and you walk on it, if that floor has expanded and contracted and it's shrunk because it's dry, and one thing I would say you could try, even though now we're coming into spring and we're going to be in summer, so it's going to be a lot, you're going to have a lot more humidity now than you would have in the winter. But one of the things I would say you could try is to get a digital hygrometer and put it in that area, in the kitchen, eating area, something like that, and see, especially in the winter when you're running that humidifier, it's hard to tell. Even though you set that humidifier and you say, well, here, I'll put it on 40, that doesn't necessarily mean it's keeping the entire house at 40% humidity. So it just is like a number of how hard you want it to work and how much moisture you want it to put out. So
I've got it turned all the way up.
Okay. So, yeah, so
it's maxed out.
The question would be is how well is that working, and are you truly having a good amount of humidity in the home during the winter? Because you could end up with having too much. So having that hygrometer that tells you right now the humidity in this area is 37% or 47% or 57%, it just kind of helps you to know where to set that humidifier at to try and keep it there. But this could also just be something's moving with the floor, you're getting a little deflection, and now that the floor is getting older and older, you'll start getting some of these squeaks, and it's just really wood rubbing on wood. And it's very hard to stop it.
The hardwood floors, I would say, were put in, oh boy, probably in 1997.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's your name?
They're not as old as the house, but, you know, I've done a lot of upgrades, you know, ceramic tile flooring and hardwood flooring. But,
yeah. So the bottom line to the actual squeak comes down to there's something between the floor joist, the subfloor, the hardwood floor, and how that's nailed and attached. And your squeak could be coming from the actual hardwood floor boards themselves. It could be coming from the hardwood floorboard kind of up against that subfloor, or it could be coming from between the floor joist and the actual subfloor, because most times when they glue that subfloor, they nail it. They're not screwing it, they're nailing that 3/4 inch wood. So if you get deflection and that glue 40 years later starts to kind of set loose in some places, sometimes a lot of the squeaks you're hearing is either the nail that's going from the 3/4 plywood down into the floor joist, or it's the nail going through the hardwood floor into that subfloor, and it's moving up and down, and that's like the rubbing, nail on wood or wood on wood rubbing and causing that to happen. So you're in that situation, Lee. I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for a great question. And yeah, it's just something you got to tighten that stuff up. We got to get to our break here for the Cardinals. We'll jump on here with David as soon as we return after the break. If you could hold, we'll be right back. Hey, go Cards. Let's all cheer them on. We love it. All right, everybody, we are back. Hey, we are here, 97.1. Love it. We got the whole rest of this hour to 1 o'clock for anything you need about your house, on, about, around, inside, outside, any maintenance, any remodeling, any questions you might have. Let's see if we can get you some good advice, maybe some good answers right here on KMOX 314-436-7900. We got David on the line. Let's see what's going on there. Hi, David.
Thanks for calling. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've been working with my mom's house. She's been having some sewer backups in her basement. And when they finally did a camera scope, she has cast iron pipes, which is kind of the, I'm not sure when they, probably that's the original pipes before everything switched to PVC, maybe in the 1980s. Maybe you could tell me a little history on that. And so this plumbing service we're using, what they want to do is dig outside in front of her house to have a, I think, an egress. And then they'll have the ability to, I guess, water clean it, or I forgot the exact term, but what they were noticing is I hope this is not TMI, she was using disposable wipes, and I guess cast iron pipes are not smooth, and the disposable wipes were getting kind of stuck in the pipe because it's not smooth, it's kind of rough surface. And this is the solution they came up with us. So wanted to ask you about this kind of situation.
Okay, yeah. So where they're digging out, are they looking to add like a vent pipe that comes up to the top of the yard? Is that why they're digging down there?
I think so. They mentioned the word egress. So I guess they need, if they're going to do maybe once a year, every 5 years to kind of, maybe, yeah. I don't know if they throw air into there, or they throw water at high pressure. Just, you know, there's no way to clean those pipes out because there's no egress. So they're going to put most of the cost is really digging down in front of her bedroom or on the outside of her bedroom. So in the future, they can do a cleanup of the pipes because of the rigidness. You know, is there rough surfaces of a cast iron pipe? Is that correct versus a PVC?
Yes. Well, that definitely does come into play there because, the cast iron pipes are a little rougher and they've been there a lot longer, so they've got things stuck into them and all that. You can still get these kind of backups with the PVC where you get joints and elbows and you know, one thing gets caught and then it starts doing it. And these disposable wipes, now I have in the past year actually found disposable wipes that are more biodegradable. So most of these wipes that we've had for the past 10 years or so that say like flushable wipes, they are not good. They do not biodegrade very well when they get in there. So I've been preaching for 10 years of not using these flushable wipes. Or you just got to really watch like how much, how often if you need them. But because toilet paper, you get too much of it or you use too much, it'll back it up because it needs time to biodegrade even in the water and all of that. So there are wipes that are more biodegradable that are better.
Any brands you can recommend?
I would have to look, but there is some out there that I don't remember what the brand was, but they are more, they've tested them better, and some plumbing associations are starting to say these are better than the other flushable wipes, or they call flushable, and they're really not. I've seen a video where they take these wipes and they kind of put them in water against like toilet paper in a bucket and this in a bucket, and it's pretty close in timing as far as breaking up and kind of starting to go away as they stir it and all that. So there are some better ones if you do a little research, and I can look back and see if I can find mine. I've got a lot of information. I've talked a lot about flushable wipes and the damage they cause. But regardless, I think That's a good way to go. If they need to get that access in the yard, that's a good thing to have for future cleanouts and all of that. And yeah, as long as there's nothing wrong with those pipes other than getting clogged up and everything, they can do, it's almost like a pressure wash, a high powered spray they send through there, like a hydrojet, and it'll blow out any gunk and all those wipes and everything, and that is a good way to clean those that drain out. Absolutely.
Can I ask one more question? My wife had heard somebody, is there a way to kind of another technique to reduce the rough surface of a cast iron pipe I don't know if somebody came up with a technique where they will coat the inside of the cast iron pipe. I don't know what they put. Have you heard anything like this that kind of makes it more of a smooth, like a PVC pipe? Have you ever heard a technique like that?
Yes. So there is a spray and liner. And when those cast iron pipes get cracks and they're really starting to get bad, they can come in and do a spray liner from the inside of that pipe, just like how they clean it out. And it does coat all the walls. I mean, it would be smoother. I don't know how much smoother. It would definitely take some of the roughness off of some of those areas where things are catching, but it's not going to get rid of it 100%. So it would be smoother, but I wouldn't say if you use flushable wipes that you're not going to get clogged up if you do that liner, because it can still clog and get caught on stuff, and you can still have those issues even if you put the liner in there. But yes, there is a spray and liner you can do, and it will make that somewhat smoother than the rough surface of that cast iron the way it is right now.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And can I just say a shout out to my daughter, Gabby. So thank you very much.
Hi.
Hi, Gabby.
Hi.
Absolutely. You're very welcome. Yep. Appreciate it. Appreciate the call and the question for sure. I will try and look back at some of my information too for those wipes that I've talked about a couple times and getting a better flushable wipe, because I know it is important, and we want to be clean, and those do work better, and there's all these advantages. But I've done story after story over the years of just, and not just like in homes, but in entire sewer services, and what the cities and what like New York and some of these cities have gone through cleaning out the systems and pulling out just gobs and pounds and pounds and pounds of these flushable wipes that just don't biodegrade. So if you're going to use them, the biggest advice I would say is one, yeah, do some research, find those wipes that are more biodegradable, that they have some backing by plumbing associations saying these are better. And then also just try and limit that use, even though they're more biodegradable. I would still try and limit that use, because what we don't consider is when we're doing that, we're like, oh yeah, I'm only using a few or this and that. Well, if there's a few in every single house, and then it all goes to the same place, and then all of a sudden, I use two or three is millions and millions of these things and thousands and thousands of houses in the St. Louis area, or think of New York and a high rise, or so it can cause some problems. So try and limit the use for sure when you can. So we're going to get into our middle hour break here. You can find me again, remember, in the next, we got another half hour, two whole segments, 314-436-7900, get you to me. We'll be right back after this. All right, everybody, we're back. Remember, Home Improvement Show here on KMOX and 97.1. You can find me, Rich Orris, here. Anything you need about your house, any questions, any concerns, anything you're trying to work on, or maybe you're about to have some work done, and kind of like Ralph had, he's going through a process and just called in on some advice about going through that and just opinions. We can help you out right here today. I'm here for you, 314-436-7900. And yeah, kind of going back through a couple of these here, the squeaky hardwood, one thing, because we spoke about with Lee about how it's different areas, and it could be here, it could be there, and there's different ways to try and solve all of that. The biggest thing is you're really trying to just get all those boards tight and stop the movement as much as you can. So one way to try and figure out if it's more in the actual top hardwood floor portion and not the actual floor joists and subfloor and things underneath, is to take a powder and put it in between, kind of work it in between those hardwood floorboards. So if there's little gaps, so you take either like baby powder or talcum powder, or like a graphite, and you just, with a real soft, you'd sprinkle, like if you took baby powder, sprinkle that baby powder all over, and you take a soft bristle brush and just kind of work that around the floor where it's working it into the gaps in that floor. It's getting down kind of to the tongue and the groove where these boards meet halfway down, and then just clean up all the excess and see if that kind of helps minimize those squeaks. And if it does, then you know you're more of a top board movement where that noise is coming from. And sometimes that might solve it for a while. And if you did that a couple times a year, maybe your squeaks are gone. There's so many different things. If you're down in the subfloor and the floor joist, they do make these brackets that you can purchase and mount to the subfloor, and you screw them to the subfloor and you mount them to the bottom of the floor joist, and then you can tighten it and really suck that subfloor down and see if that helps. And then of course the one thing that you don't want to do too much of on a hardwood floor is just sandwich that all together by going from the top down and screwing through or nailing through everything to get down to the floor joist and really reattach that hardwood floor bore to the subfloor, to the floor joist, and try and eliminate that squeak. But then again, you're on a hardwood floor and you'll end up with a hole you have to fill and cover, and you get too many of them. You don't want to have that everywhere, but that's kind of the end solution of I've tried everything on the market and it's just not working. But also jumping back a little bit to the mulch conversation and the termites and the wood. And again, this is one of the reasons that I took out all my mulch and I put rock everywhere, ground cloth, rock, decorative rock, and just really try and get rid of all the possibilities of wood, mulch, termites, all the things that can happen. But a quick Google search has just basically given me the information that there really isn't a specifically treated, you know, mulch isn't specifically treated for termites. There's some types of wood that can kind of keep them away a little better than others. And of course, the amount of moisture in that wood. So if you just had a tree cut down and there's a lot of moisture in that wood, like Bob had that tree cut down and it was all ground up and they use that as mulch, if there's a lot of moisture, that will address those termites even more. They come after that moisture, it'll track them to there, because that's the other thing other than the food source. They like it moist, and that's where they're going to kind of go to. Ants, other insects are the same way. They're looking for the moisture in that food as they do it. Years ago, we had, prior to the whole termite thing I was talking about, we had ants coming in our master bathroom, and we've got a kind of bumped out bay window, and they were coming in all around the tub and that bay window. And my wife's like, oh my gosh. And she's trying to put some traps and kill the ants, and we should call an exterminator. And I said, no, we don't really need any of that. And I said, let me fix the outside. And I went to the outside and I tore off the wood trim and all the stuff at the bottom of this window where all this water was getting in, and there was and that's where those ants were. They were harvesting towards that moisture, and that's why they were coming in. So replacing that wood, wrapping everything with a house wrap, protecting it from water, and then retrimming around the outside of that window took care of my ant issue. And I didn't need the exterminator and the traps and all the things on the inside. They just eventually went away and went to a different place to try and find a different moisture source to have and live in and all of that. So something to consider if you're having issues with ants and things like that is to have the house examined and think about moisture and wood rot and what's inside the walls and do you have the proper house wrap and then all these other issues that go on with our houses attract these insects to them. So that can be a bigger problem than you think when you're getting some ants inside. Could be an issue with the house. So, but going all the way back to Ralph's first initial call conversation about the kitchen remodel, about transparency, and about really trying to figure out ways to save money, lower the investment of a kitchen remodel. He was pretty much on the ball of all the different ways, because when you look at any remodel, if you're trying to bring that investment down, typically the ways that happen is, one, look at materials. Is there any way to change the materials? Is there any way to repick, sink, faucet, some of the stuff that you're, you know, those materials you're putting in there to kind of save some money on that aspect of it. And so re-examining all of that is a way to see if we could bring that down a little bit. And then, of course, the size of the project is another biggie. That's where you really get the most reduced cost on a kitchen or a bathroom or any type of project like that. Is there some of the project that you can do at a later date or that you don't really need to do? So can you remodel your kitchen without a new floor at this particular time? That's going to save you more than 20 little things stacking up. Or so limiting the size is one way. And then, of course, sweat equity, client involvement. That's another big one of what can I do to try and help out. Now, I can also definitely kind of warn you and give you some information from our end of the industry. One, demolition, that's the easiest one, and that's the first one that everybody goes to. Like Ralph was saying, what if I took out the cabinets? What if I did this type of work? And we've often seen it where we let someone do the demolition of something. Like, they're, all right, we'll strip the walls, we'll take everything out of the bathroom, we'll strip the walls down to studs. And we're like, okay, perfect. And then we walk in to do the job, and there's 1,000 nails in all the wood still. And we're like, oh, so we need this ready to go. And so we're doing demo to be able to keep working, because, and so that's the concern of our end of make sure you get it right. And then the other surprising part of performing the demo yourself is, when you walk into a bathroom or a kitchen, I mean, you're talking like a day or two. If it's a job we're going to work on for 30 days and two of those days are taking it out, and that 2 days is a labor rate that's less, because it's might not necessarily be the same skilled people that do everything, then you might be surprised at what little that saves you on doing just the demo. But if there's other things that you can do, then perfect. And I've had them in the past. We've been through it. And the last one I did about a year ago, where, I mean, we worked through this project to work this thing down, and there was actually the homeowner is very good, has done a lot of work, a lot of DIY work himself throughout the years. So there was actually like one area that he's going to put the flooring in the entire first floor remodel. He's doing his own new doors, his own trims, base trims around the window. So we had to get to that amount of work to really start saving the bigger dollars that he was like, all right, now I'm starting to feel comfortable. So he's doing his own doors, floors in one room. He's doing his own trim around the base trim, the doors, the windows, and he's painting everything himself. So he took on a good percentage of that project to really knock a lot off there. So that's, again, something that can happen and should be able to happen. But again, from our perspective, from the company's perspective, one, if you don't want to be involved and you let us handle everything and we're a good company and we get through all this, you're going to have a better outcome that will be quicker, that will get you through, and less stress and less involvement and all of that. So there's some, I can see the insecurities of the contractor saying, I don't really want to let somebody do that because it just causes issues for me that can cause me then to lose money or to have to pay more and more time in trying to get through this when you're trying to involve. And that's why here at Mosby Building Arts, we have so many of our own employees and less subcontracting going on because it's more controlled and we can control the whole environment. So when a homeowner gets involved kind of as a subcontractor, yeah, there can be some delays and insecurities. And do you slow us down? Does it cost us more money because you're trying to do some of it? And that, just understand that's the concern. And that's the conversations that we need to have when we get into these situations and we go, I'm willing to let you do this, but you got to help me stay on track. You got to get through it. You got to get your painting done when I say, so that I can proceed into these different areas of work and not have it cost more time and labor for us to do what we're doing, or we're showing up and something's not ready. So that's why a lot of companies don't want to do that. I totally get that. But to help people get them into great projects and everything, sometimes, yes, we have to work through and let you buy your appliances and let you do some of the trim and the painting and the doors and things like that in order to help you get a good project and get what your heart really desires. That's what everyone should be after in the end. So, hey, we're going to take our final break of the hour here. We'll be back shortly. We'll have plenty more home improvement for you. If you need anything in the final segment, 314-436-7900 is how you'll find me. We'll be right back. All right. We are back. Final segment. If you need something, get in quick. 314-436-7900. Love to help you out. But meantime, I'm going to kind of continue on with that whole kind of discussion of get into the next half of that discussion with Ralph on the company, the transparency, and trying to get information out of them and trying to see how you can bring investment levels down. And, you know, we did talk a lot at that point about really finding someone that you're comfortable with and that is at least helping you with the conversations and showing the effort and trying to get the investment level down. And are they willing to let you perform some of the work? How much of that do you think you can do? There is a lot in figuring all that out and a lot to go through, and that's okay. We just need to take the time and have good open conversations to know what that is and understand it and see where we can go and make those good decisions for you and with you. But we're also a little reliable on just advising along the way of the things that can happen and what we're trying to control. Like I was saying, if we handle 100% of everything, then the responsibility is pretty much 100% of everything on us, which makes it a little easier and a little better for you getting through it and not having to worry about things. Like I was saying with the appliances is, yeah, you know, if something happens, we're going to be like, you should talk to your appliance people about fixing that floor or that cabinet that they damaged or anything of those concerns. So it's really how much of that do you think you want to handle or you want to take care of? So consider all that when you're going through all these processes and talking with everybody. But hey, we've got Rick on the line. Let's get here and see what's going on. Rick, can you hear me?
Yeah, Rich, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
It's deck season here, looking to get a deck, and I had a question. I'm hearing a lot of talk about joist tape, taping the top of the joist, a wood joist. Do you know anything about that? Any thoughts on whether it works or don't work, or what do you think?
I mean, it can buy you some time. It's kind of like on a roof when we do ice and water shield, and when you nail through it, it kind of seals that nail. Now, if water keeps getting to it, it's eventually going to wear that out. So it's kind of like a really, really good Band-Aid that can buy you some time. So it's the same way on that deck floor, putting that tape across there. And then when you screw in, it'll kind of seal that up. But eventually, all that water, and you get a lot more water there than you do on the roof because you've got the shingles to protect it over time.
Right.
So you get that water there. It eventually will wear through that tape. So it's a good thing to do. It will buy you a little bit of time. But it is definitely not really necessary per se, just because, I mean, decks and treated wood deck frames, I mean, they last like 30 years, 40 years sometimes. So I don't have an answer on is if you put that tape on there, does it add 5 years? I'm not sure. It will lengthen the life expectancy some, but it's really about weighing the expense of how much does it cost to add it, and do I think I'm adding 5 years to a 30-year deck? Do I need to add 5 years to a 30-year deck?
Okay. The company I talked to, they say it's about $3.50 a square foot labor material to put it down. So mm-hmm. 300 square foot deck, you're looking over $1,000. Seems like a lot of money.
Yeah.
So tape on there.
Yep, and that's why looking at all these decisions is also so personal too, because if you're 70, I mean, it's not necessarily going to help you.
I'm 71. That's what I was thinking.
Your deck's going to last. I mean, you make it to 100 and you're that. It's still probably going to have a good frame in 29 years.
One more question on decks again. How about the composite floor joist? That's something that's new. Someone else told me about that. The new Owens Corning has a composite floor joist. You any experience with those?
That I do not. I've seen and discussed quite a little bit about like steel metal floor joist. But I haven't dealt a lot at all with that composite.
Okay. Well, what's your thoughts on steel? I had people are aluminum or steel either way. What's your thoughts on that product? That's expensive.
But. So that's expensive. Again, a deck's going to last a good long time. And the worrisome about the steel is it has to be painted and coated, and it can rust if it gets scratched. It's a little bit harder with that to kind of change things and make the deck with the angles, and it takes a little more labor to put that in. And so to me, there's pros and cons to both sides. And it's like, okay, if you're 30 and you're going to be in this house when you're 80, maybe the steel's worth the money right now. But if I can use treated lumber and say you're going to get like 30 years out of that frame, that's good enough for most people.
That's what I thought, because that steel is around 30% higher than the treated.
Yes. So
that's quite, you know, on a $30,000 deck, that's $9,000. That's quite a jump.
Yes.
You know, like you said, yep. Depends on your age. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so it's worth going to that if you know the outcome and you know how long you're going to be there. But most people just don't even live in their houses that long. So
That's a good point. Thank you, Rich. I appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, Rick. Good question. Good call. And yeah, we do decks, and we're talking about this all the time. And for the most part, yeah, we're doing the treated, and it lasts well, and we have good results and long enough results for our clients that it's just not always worth jumping up so much in the investment to get to something that is going to outlast them. But hey, had a great time, had a lot of good conversations and questions. I'll look to talk to everybody next week. From now, just remember, be good to each other, be good to your homes, and I'll talk to everybody next week.